In the old days, the teaching of non-duality was hidden. It was reserved for the disciples who had become advanced enough to have achieved the humility of the ego and its yearning for the presence of God, the realization of God, that brought the consciousness out of a narcissistic state into its upper death drive and yearning for freedom from the limitations of a finite consciousness. And these secret teachings, they remain secret for a number of generations until the social order in which the transmission from guru to disciple after a long period of individual study was no longer possible. Cultural conditions changed, especially in India, once they were invaded and once there was a loss of the coherence of the cultural Vedic context. And then the Vedantic writings, the Upanishads, and then the Agamas, and then the writings, the Karikas, the commentaries on the Upanishads, most famously the Mandukya Karika of Gaudapada, changed all that and brought the secret teachings out into the public sphere. One could say that this was actually a terrible disaster for spirituality, because the result, at least it certainly is apparent in the current context, is that at the ego level, if one learns that the ultimate truth is non-duality while still within a narcissistic shell of the ego, then the ego will appropriate that concept and believe it is already there without having broken through its shell, and will justify not growing out of its narcissistic pseudo-identity because, hey, we're already all one, what's the point? And it will then stunt its own growth using the rationalization that we're all God anyway, why bother? And so in the traditional paths, there was always a graduated approach, at least in terms of the guru recognizing what level of teaching a student was ready for. Some would come who were ready for non-dual knowledge because they were already in soul consciousness. They had been living very virtuous, ascetic, simple, pure lives and lives of devotion to God, and then that knowledge could come as an instant shock of recognition. But what happens nowadays with that teaching is that it simply gets filed away as another way to impress oneself that one knows already before one has ever even begun to glimpse that which is represented in all of the language of all of the holy scriptures of every religion as the glory of God, the majesty of God, the awesome infinite nature of the presence of God. And so one never breaks through beyond the event horizon of ego consciousness in order to be able to gaze upon and be absorbed into that the exquisite, blissful, luminous power of the Supreme Presence. And it remains simply a theory. Or perhaps an occasional glimpse and a reception of crumbs or bits of knowledge that come from the superconscious, but nothing that brings about a transformative effect. And the postmodern ego is structurally incapable of adoration of God. And yet, without adoration, opening one's heart to that total yearning to realize the sublime, the even beyond sublime, presence of the truth of the real of what we are, then is never encountered. So this creates a technical difficulty in presenting a teaching, because everyone already thinks they know all that, but they know it at the wrong level, and then it turns into anti-knowledge rather than true knowledge of the heart. It just becomes something mental. And if it's not the heart's wisdom and the heart's opening to union with that Supreme Self, then all of the efforts one makes in meditation or otherwise becomes futile and barren of results. And so this is the difficulty of the postmodern ego, even if one is motivated to transcend the boundaries of one's limited consciousness identified with the body, that there's a resistance to surrender, because it's been indoctrinated that one should do it my way and stay in pseudo-autonomy and figure it out for myself. I'm not going to, let others manipulate me or exploit me or become dependent on anyone, etc. So there's a rationalization. And that's only one of many kinds of rationalizations for not recognizing the true situation of the consciousness still identified with ego, and talking itself into believing it's free when it's still imprisoned, but imprisoned within its own set of desires and fears that it takes to be its natural habitat. So, let's see. Thank you. So the yogis came up with an important definition of Maya as the obstacle, which could be defined as imagining that what one is imagining is happening outside of one's imagination. And for most people in the ego, that's the definition of reality, not Maya. The definition, because of the mistaking of the unreal for the real and the real for the unreal, is that the belief that your imagination is actually a world that you are in rather than the world being within your imagination creates then a loss of empowerment and of free will and of the power to dream, because one has consented to identify as an artifact of the dream, of the dreamer who is, yes, in non-duality oneself, but if you are identified with the character, now there is a need to worship our Lord, because it's no longer the self within that frame of reference. And until one has broken free of that frame, one will not be able to establish one's consciousness free of one's imagination in the real. And so it is this that we mean by breaking through to the light, which is the subject of our next retreat. Not that I'm trying to answer a question that hasn't been asked, but nonetheless, that's really what's being pointed to here as being necessary to find a technique that will overcome this thick postmodern shell of resistant, nihilistic, cynical oppositionalism, which is self-defeating and self-sabotaging at every turn in order to keep its growth from happening and to stay stunted throughout life as an infant. It's called the Peter Pan complex among Jungians, or puer eternus complex, if you're more academically inclined, but it's simply the common state of the ego today, because in this fallen culture, no one goes through the rite of passage that leads to ego death, or even to adulthood, in which one could choose ego death. And so this becomes a technical problem for those on the spiritual path and those who are functioning as guides. Now, in the Sufi tradition, they had a very interesting way. I put it in the past because I think there are very few authentic Sufi sages any longer, at least I don't know of too many. But the first stage, well, maybe I'll try to write it. Let's see. Oh, I kept it here, yeah. There was the Sharia, and then the Tariqa, and then the Hakika stage. Now, I think that there are actually stages beyond these three, but in the Sharia stage, your relationship to God was one of asking for mercy and forgiveness for one's sins and for help in purification. And this is why in Islam there is so much prostration. But you see this in Tibet, you see it in Bhutan, you see this in religion, you see it in Christianity with people kneeling as they go into the cathedrals, especially in Mexico and South America, right? There's that same very humble prostration to God. But how many Westerners would be willing to actually take a path of prostration and really do a pilgrimage, you know, around Lhasa or around Mount Kailash, or even do Giri Pradakshina around Mount Arunachala? You know, there is very little willingness to humble oneself. And the ego is always trying to become empowered without first surrendering to the power that can empower one, and thus remains only with a fantasy of power, if that. So in the Sharia, you admit you're in duality, and you are worshiping Allah and praying to Allah. In the Tariqa phase, you are receiving grace. Now your relationship to Allah, to God, to Buddha consciousness, doesn't matter what you call it, is that of receiving the power that will then be turned into love, wisdom, the capacity to serve, the capacity to live coherently and authentically. And one will be nurtured by one's connection to God that gets stronger and stronger in meditation, until one receives that lightning bolt that one can finally tolerate, which is the moment when it is written in the texts, you cannot see the face of God and live. And that lightning strike will incinerate the ego instantaneously. And that's the entrance into Hakika. You remember Al-Halaj, who famously, a Sufi sage, said, "Ana al-Haq, I have become Haq. I have achieved that Hakika." And of course, they burned him at the stake, because you're not allowed to say that in dualistic religions. But nonetheless, that's always been the real path of the Sufi, who recognizes in that moment of Hakika that all is Allah, and therefore there cannot be such thing as a religion of Islam. Every religion is Allah's religion, every path. There is no path, and it's all beauty, it's all truth, it's all goodness. And then the non-duality, that vision becomes real, not simply a belief or a fantasy. But if the scales haven't fallen away and one does not see with the third eye, then one doesn't really perceive the radiance of God's presence. And then it becomes something that is never realized, but only talked about or thought about or read about. So in that phrase, nobody son of nobody, if you think about it, which was written by a famous Sufi poet, a well-renowned sage, what does that mean? To realize I am no body, what am I? I am not only bodiless, but I am not an identifiable individual person or being in a world. And I am the son of nobody, right? If I am not the son, and let's say son, daughter, offspring, child of God, it's not obviously a gendered issue. If I am not a son then what does that mean? Doesn't that mean I am the father or the mother or the absolute itself, not some derivative? So non-duality is being expressed, but it's being expressed in a dualistic phrase. And the Sufis could get away with that, even though they were expressing non-duality in that, because it was a humble submission of the ego to that inconceivable presence. But then I would say that there are stages beyond that, like we could say there is the sahaja samadhi phase, and there is, let's say, the prakasha vimarsha phase, and then there is the complete satchit ananda, and then finally anuttara or anuttara samyak sambodhi if you're a Buddhist. So in the sahaja samadhi, this becomes ceaseless. There is no longer any modulation. The elimination of all the sanskaras that would bring back the illusion of duality are dissolved. And then the actual mind and luminous presence of God that is described in the Bhagavad Gita as brighter than a thousand suns, or that kind of language of total infinite light, the eternal light, then becomes the direct perception, and worldness is washed out, and then the satchit ananda of the bliss, the actual bliss of the intelligence of the transcendent Godhead, and then finally the inconceivable absolute, from which there is those who are in that state tend to leave the body and not be around long to talk about it. But it is visible in some sages who remained slightly enough connected to the form to be able to transmit that vibrational frequency to a disciple or two before leaving the phenomenal dream field. So we're in that state now of approaching that point of the collapse of the social order, when we will have to be autonomous. We will have to be able to depend on our own intelligence and wisdom and think outside the box, because the box will be empty. It won't function anymore. None of the one's usual repertoire of means of navigating through the world will be of any help. And only the supreme presence will be the support, the bedrock, and the power that will sustain those who are going through the final time of tribulations. And the tribulations are internal as well as external for those who are not in that state. In fact, they are pretty much all internal, because it's at that point that everything that one imagines as being outside can no longer be put at a distance, and it turns into a mental disorder of such horror and dread and anxiety and terror and all of that, that one will not want to fall into such a hell realm. I'm sure that anyone who can see it coming will say, I'm going in another direction, thank you. But can you see it coming? Because the ego has no control over what erupts from the subconscious. But it imagines it does. And so its false bravado causes it to think it can bluff its way, but don't think you can bluff God. It's very important. He can read the cards in your hand, no matter how close you hold them to your chest. So I would say it's much better to surrender while you can afford the ante, rather than to get into such karmic debt that can't be paid off. So this is why yogis have been so concerned about the welfare of humanity, knowing that it would end either in total demonic possession and mental disorder and chaotic agony, or in bliss. The Rudra Tandava or the Ananda Tandava. Two dances are going on simultaneously. Which dance hall do you want to go into? And this is open to all, but the ticket is adoration and surrender. And then once you're in, you get blessings, power, and joy, and the wisdom to then blossom fully, activate your crown chakra. The kundalini leaves the body and enters into complete recognition of its infinite presence, rather than limited to what can be perceived through the five senses, and is freed of the illusion of its imagination. And once the dream field is completely understood, and it can only be understood by the infinite intelligence, if you want to know why it is unfolding the way it is for you and for whomever you are concerned about, or for the world at large, or the cosmos, the symbolic nature and the karmic currents and pathways that create the conditions of life for every being and their degree of awakening or suffering can be altered from that plane in which there are no obstructions of fixed conceptualizations about reality, and all is perceived in its true nature as a manifestation of the one self, the one intelligence. And what becomes apparent, among many other things, is that only a very few beings will choose the Ananda Tandava. And that must be accepted without any sense of imperfection. in how the dream unfolds and how it culminates. And at the moment that is usually referred to as the last judgment, which is really your own realization of your judgment of yourself that either allowed or prevented the realization of the Absolute. Then the entirety of the wheel of karma becomes clearly present as the theodrama in which all of the various permutations of the soul's self-characterization become clearly present as the self-portrait of one's relationship to that ultimate intelligence is drawn. So in the Quran it says Allah created the world because he wanted to be known, you see, but wanted to be known by himself. And so it is this question of, do you want to know the power that has created you? And to know that you are known, because that knowledge is the realization of the unity of the knower and the known. And it's only when there has been a total surrender of the will to be separate that the grace of stillness will be granted, that is the portal to the awesome presence of the radiant self that is everywhere and nowhere. So, the truth is the non-duality of duality and non-duality, meaning no free will at the ego level, total freedom at the level of your real self, and there must be a choice between these two levels of possibility of self-expression and of lines of flight of experience through the permutations of the unfoldment of the dream field in accord with one's willingness to know the truth. Because the ego doesn't want to know, it resists. It prefers denial, it prefers being comfortably numb, like the Pink Floyd song famously sings, right? Except it's not so comfortable anymore, and the anesthesia wears off and turns into a kind of dread eventually. So there's a moment of truth that will come, and the only question is, what level of truth does one want to encounter? But we have the freedom at the level of surrender to that supreme power of the creative intelligence of the real self, that in those moments when grace is granted, even for a glimpse, the choice to evacuate the ego, to abide, to take refuge, to unite with the Supreme Presence is open to everyone. And there is now a margin of time in which that grace is given to all who wish it before the final dissolution of the nightmare that the world has become out of God's mercy will be completed. And this is the time to decide your destiny. And the rest will follow from the willingness to surrender and follow the guidance, the inspiration, the calling of the heart that will be given, but that the ego will still resist and will have to be overcome with the margin of clarity, courage, and coherence that one will also be given to break through the resistance. But still, it will be a question of what is one determined to attain? And on the other hand, what would one settle for in terms of one's potency for full development of your psycho-spiritual potentialities? I think I'll stop there and open the floor if anyone has questions or comments or anything you would like to contribute to this conversation or this process or anything you would like to ask about. So, floor is open. Please go to the mic. I think we have a mic up there.
Thank you. Thank you. Testing. Beautiful teaching, super relevant for me. So, I mean, I experience different levels of surrender. I mean, it was great the first three, but I'm wondering if you could walk through just as you wrote them, but surrender, so like the third is the realization that you are it, but it feels like maybe surrender may be occurring through all seven levels or no?
Well, yes, I would say at least through five of them, because once there really is absorption, then there is no one left separate to surrender. And then at that point, it's simply the presence itself that unfolds, and one's character becomes a bodhisattva spontaneously transmitting that energy and wisdom, but without any ego involved in it. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, in a way that starts at hakika, but it's when it's sahaja and the stability has been attained, and then the prakasha vimarsha in state five is really when you become a manifestation of the glory of God and the intelligence of God. The vimarsha is the intelligence, and the prakasha is the light. And then the ananda of the ultimate bliss of that intelligence and that recognition of the infinite beauty of the dream that is the reflection of the dreamer, and the dream and the dreamer become one in that state.
So perhaps you can give further understanding, maybe I didn't catch it, on how to break through this double bind from the ego, in which it's the ticket out is through adoration and surrender, and yet it's impossible for the ego to adore God. So from within the ego, right, mm-hmm. it's in a double bind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
So how do we get out of
it? Yeah, well, this is the fascinating thing. God has made it impossible for himself to free himself from a trap that he has self-created, right? I say he, but it's not it, and it's not, neither he nor she ultimately, but it is intelligence that for its own amusement had to create this kind of a Zen koan to overcome an impossibility. And the way that we're going to have a whole retreat on this, because I don't think I can give you a description of a one-line formula for it, but a series of exercises I think that will help to bring that insight directly to bear subjectively, right, rather than simply through a concept. There is within the ego a love of power, intelligence, and greatness, okay? When you realize that that is not achievable at the level of the ego, the power you want, the security you want, the safety, even the wealth, because of the potentiality of what consciousness can bring. Not that there would be greed on the part of one who is in God consciousness, but there would be abundance and prosperity and sufficiency for what was necessary, like the manna from heaven that was always enough for the day, right? And that kind of trust and faith produces that kind of an outcome. So there would be a recognition that one lacks the real power that one desires, and lacks the knowledge of how to achieve it or break through. And the only way to get that is to surrender. So there will be a moment in which it is a calculably the wisest path in accord with the ego's own frame of reference. You know, remember Pascal, who wrote the Pensées, and he said, we have to take a wager, you know, which makes more sense, not believing in God and then discovering, oh, I was wrong, you know, at the end, and you go to hell instead of heaven because you didn't bother to find out, or taking a chance and then finding out, well, there wasn't a God, but at least I lived in a godly way, and I can be... feel good that I led a virtuous life and a life in which I was growing psychologically and spiritually and serving, etc. So it is a kind of a gamble, and the ego is a gambler. And when you realize that you're better off gambling on God than on your own ego's ability to get through it without that grace, then I think it becomes the course of action that even a very calculating ego is going to take. But you do have to come out of denial in order to even reach that point. Please, Nirgun. Ah, okay. You go ahead. You got up first, Karuna. Nirgun will come after you.
It's a question that came up, kind of on the relationship between tapas and abiding in the zero point, because I remember you gave this teaching on Kashmir Shaivism of the five levels of meditation of Kshipta, Vikshipta, leading into Niruddha.
Yes.
And you gave the advice to focus on the third eye and let's say expand that light or let that light grow.
Yes.
So that it would silence the mind and purify the sanskaras.
Yes.
And then in the last teaching that you gave on Wednesday, you were speaking of turning off the light of the projector and abiding in the zero point and letting go from there. So I guess my question is, are these two the same? Will that abidance lead to the tapas in the end anyways?
So when I said before, turn off the light, what it means is don't project the light any longer onto a screen, right?
Uh-huh.
The power that, that makes that light able to be luminescent is the electricity. That's still available. But you want to go to the source of it, not project it, but withdraw from all projection into the absolute source in which there is no world and there is no you even. Because there is only that absolute presence in which, because there is no conceptualization and no dreaming even happening, there is just that total purity that is inconceivable to the ego mind, right? But that becomes one's total being, right? So the tapas is the process of heating up the mind and gradually burning away the sanskaras so that one can get to that point. But you can't just go there because there's too much resistance. But the tapas is the prayer and the meditation and the inner work and the study that will gradually clarify and make your mind more coherent, so that all of whatever margin of willpower is available is going toward that and not diverting onto the screen and being interested in the character. So there'll be a total disinvestment in the projection and a total investment in the source of the power. And then the light will go on again because you will have dreamed there's no scratches on it. They will have burned away in the tapas, right? Just like a scratch in a diamond, it can be polished because the scratch isn't usually very deep, but you've got to do the polishing. That's what the tapas really represents. And then everything is clear and all is beautiful.
Thank you. That's very inspiring and motivating. It's a thought that came up yesterday as well, thinking about, isn't it possible to polish the scratch away?
Yes. So, oh yeah, it is. But again, you have to do it and not believe that that scratch is reality. It was just a temporary wound that saturated the consciousness that was already projecting itself into duality, right?
And so I guess the last question is as one keeps polishing and clarifying the mind and purifying, it becomes easier to surrender. That resistance does become less.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And that's why persevere and don't let any setbacks cause you to feel depressed or hopeless. No, there's no such thing. But, you know, when you fall, you dust yourself off, you get back on your horse and you ride. You don't give up no matter what.
There's been a lot of that going on. but I'll continue.
Learn from it. That's the key. Mm-hmm. Learn from every mistake or every sense of failure of holding to the real self, because you will learn the sanskara that underlies that event, which wasn't a failure at all, because it was meant for you then to investigate what is the cause of it. And in learning that, you will come to understand yourself. And when you understand yourself, because you're a fractal of the whole, you will understand everything and everyone. So it's all about growth. Take the whole process as an education. And the curriculum involves apparent failure that you have to turn into success through gaining the wisdom of why it happened and what you were to gain and let go of in order to go to the next level.
That's beautiful and extraordinarily helpful. Thank you.
I'm so glad. Thank you, Karuna. Excellent questions. Jurgen, do you still have one?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Shinya. Yeah, my question is about Sharia, and I'm familiar with the term Sharia law, and I'm wondering if it's akin to the Dharma.
Yes, it's the equivalent of Dharma. But again, Dharma is a very subtle term. Dharma is not a set of rules, okay? Most people take it that way. Oh, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't eat these things, I can't, you know, all of that. No, no, no. Dharma is the principle that will enable you to avoid suffering and stay within the accessibility of the Shakti that will bring you out of the ego, right? So it's wisdom. But you will have to accumulate that first by learning the principles through the experience of what will be taken as rules, until you realize that they are like, you know, the training wheels on a bike. And then once you don't need them, obviously you let them go. And the Dharma becomes, it is the Tao. It's the equivalent of receiving that direct download of knowledge in real time that you will intuitively know that will bring about a spontaneous, accurate response to whatever is occurring. Okay?
Thank you. Is it also akin to the act of binding oneself to God while one is still in duality? And
yeah, I think that's very good. I think that's exactly what we have to do. But it has to be binding with love, right? And of total loyalty, faith, and a recognition that this is all that is important. This is the mitzvah, the commandment, the portal to liberation is loving God with all your heart, soul, might, everything. And when you are offering that, then you'll reach the next phases very quickly. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Namaste. Thank
Namaste.
You. I just felt I needed to come here.
Good.
I'm just feeling a lot of gratitude in my heart. Mm.
That's beautiful. Gratitude is the medicine, because
yes.
It's love, right? Love of God, really.
Yes.
And that brings grace.
And it is related to what you've been speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the question or your answer to Karuna as well about this persevering and the yearning to somehow find a way to navigate life and understand what is happening inside. Mm-hmm. And I've had a few as fortunate enough, one can say, to step into an issue with my family at home in Sweden. And I've just been amazed of how it has developed. These encounters with the with my family has often left me feeling more like victimized for many years. But this time it's like I have been able to feel this dispassion to what is happening, and to not worrying about the outcome of what's going to happen, and it's left me with a lot of silence and freedom inside when I'm dealing with, and there's come so much understanding from why there have been all these reactions and the dynamics in the family. I've never seen that before so clearly. It's amazing.
That's good.
It's
third eye is starting to open, Nirmala.
It just brings up a lot of, instead of anger, I used to be angry, it brings up a lot of compassion with everyone.
Sure. Compassion and dispassion, right? You said both, and you need both.
Yeah? Yes. So it's been such a revelation for me from having really struggled with this for so many years and almost felt it's hopeless, and now I start to see the fruits of the meditations and the teachings and the persevering. I'm just very grateful, thank you.
It's beautiful that you are letting go of that enmeshment with those beings you call your family. Now, they're really only the family of your body. And as soon as you no longer identify with the body, you will realize, well, maybe this is my family because I am much more attuned to the beings here. But even isn't God my father, mother, and really the whole family is in that unified field of consciousness, not even in the phenomenal plane. And so the more that you let go and feel the dispassion, you can't be victimized, you can't be caught in a conflict of loyalties, and you give yourself entirely, your heart entirely, and your mind to that supreme presence that is love and joy and wisdom, then you will find you are not only navigating, but being navigated by that power through the world. And you'll be able to just rest in the peace of realizing that it is God unfolding your destiny in the most beautiful way, and all you have to do is enjoy the ride, right? There's no effort that needs to be made, and it's really only God and Goddess attaining union again. It's a dance of Shiva and Shakti, and you are able to then join that Ananda Tandava and dance your way into the blissful light.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It sounds beautiful.
I appreciate your sharing. Oh, sure.
Namaste. My question, I was fascinated by what you said, your definition of Maya and the difference, and it's very subtle as you said it, so I want to see if I got it correctly. You said Maya is imagining that what one is imagining is happening outside one's imagination rather than in one's imagination. So the world outside instead, right. The world inside.
Yeah, it's a dream.
It's a dream, exactly. So the question is, how does the shift happen? What has to happen for that shift of one seeing the world outside of one's imagination and understanding that the world is actually in one's imagination? How does that change of understanding?
Uh-huh. Okay, you remember the flight of the Garuda, where he's talking about there being these two states, right? Mm-hmm. Technically, he's right, except that in the when the original state of the newborn becomes traumatized, that's when it believes it's in a dangerous situation, and it projects that it's an external danger, and it identifies with the body that now becomes an object of fearful, paranoid need for protection or aggressivity to defend itself, etc. But before that, it would not happen until the acquisition of language. And you would see the newborn would be in just a state of wonder and awe and joy, right? And so if there isn't any trauma, the natural state is that of non-duality. And then when one begins to believe that one is answerable to those calling one's name, and one is identified by those others in the dream as a body, one is pulled into it because of the body's need for their approval, and then their frame of reference of duality becomes one's own system of thinking, mm-hmm. right? And then everything is labeled, and one's consciousness is infested by language and thoughts. And there's never any silence and freedom to realize again it's all a dream, because the thinking, which is both defensive and desirous, is always needing to make sure that it is in a secure and safe situation and things are under control, right? Mm-hmm. So then one is obsessed with that dualistic frame of reference and trying to sustain it in a way that is comfortable, right? Mm-hmm. So once one is able to recognize that one gave in to a certain set of forces that were appearing in the dream that were sufficiently seductive and intimidating in combination, mm-hmm. One fell under that spell. And the reason they call it a spell is that you learn to spell words and they get spelled in your mind, and then you lose the actual sovereignty over your own consciousness, because the language is installed by the other along with the desires of the other, originally the mother and then the whole family system, and then that becomes what you are answerable to, and you become perhaps victimized by it, but also sustained and needy of that support because of the now lost wholeness and true empowerment that would give you sovereignty and the ability to stand alone and say no. Because you have to be able to say no if you want to authentically say yes. And otherwise, you're living an inauthentic life and you're having to say things you don't believe in order to pacify, you know, the parents and the system, that if you spoke too much truth, they would, you know, oust you or punish you or whatever, which is now, you see, happening in the external world. They're arresting journalists and those who are speaking too much uncomfortable truths. So there's a recapitulation at every fractal level of that internal trauma that every ego these days undergoes almost from the beginning of life.
You speak of a stage you have spoken in your teachings where you start seeing the magic of the dream, like the impossibility, synchronicities, just things that are very uncanny that start happening that are showing you that there's something particularly, unreal and yet very real at the same time, right?
Yes.
Unreal of the world and very real of the supreme real.
Yes. That's right. You're given a constant set of clues that don't take this seriously as a standalone world outside yourself, because you are dreaming it, even though you have lost your understanding that that is the case. And the more that you're able to appreciate the beauty of the dream, which will first come perhaps as a gratitude for the mercy of God in giving you whatever those synchronicities or, let's say, bits of paranormally gained information and sense of peace and serenity and joy that can happen in those moments in which one is able to connect with one's real self, then if one can start to have faith in the surreal nature of the dream field and begin to explore that and play with it, one will see that, yes, there are powers that can be developed if one accepts the magical nature of a consciousness and its ability to influence what unfolds in the morphogenic field, right? And then one begins to realize, well, to do that, I need to attune to a much more subtle level of intelligence. And then I have to silence the gross chatter of the mind in order to receive that wisdom and direct real-time information. And then one is able to live in that virtual reality, not in the actual, and gradually perceive that all of time is present now, and all of the wisdom accumulated by the soul, past and future, is all available if you are willing to access that amount of truth that will be ego-shattering. That's the price for that knowledge.
Beautiful. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay, a question from Gyana. A situation of absolute horror and satanic evil has come to my awareness.
Oh.
I recognize it as my imagination, and I keep surrendering. And yet I feel like I keep falling prey to that horror being done to a loved one so young, and the hell that they are in, and the seduction for others to fall into that hell along with them. I keep surrendering the hell that keeps arising, which I know is mine. I feel like I am in a trap that I may not get out. I keep flickering between the devotion and love of God and the horror of the images of the projection, knowing that all that is important is my oneness with God. I feel there is no grace, and yet I know that I would not be experiencing this to be let go without grace being present. Am I connecting with a deep belief that God is evil, or becoming aware that God is all that is? What needs to shift within me so this imaging stops? I realize that it is all an illusion, and yet I'm being shown that I don't believe it.
Well, it's not an illusion at the level that you are seeing it. You're not perceiving it as such. But if you will allow yourself to surrender to God and accept that whatever happens is the will of God, and that God is pure goodness, but of an inconceivable nature because of infinite intelligence that transcends what you are perceiving as good and evil and as horror, which may not be actually the case of what's happening, and perceive that the one it is happening to is not a victim, but is also a manifestation of God who has chosen to learn through that experience and can perceive that divine nature in that being, then just by having that perception, you will transmit the vibrational frequency of God consciousness to the being who is apparently suffering, and through their connection to you, they can receive the understanding and the direct presence of God as the ultimate intelligence that has brought this about in order to bring about an internal transformation. And that being will be able to turn the suffering immediately into grace and into salvation, into bliss. And so you have to let go of your own labeling of it as horror, because that this being a dream will keep the dream recording this event to you and to whoever is experiencing that in the dream field in that manner. Whereas if you will let go of that and be without judgment, you will see that the outcome can actually reveal itself as a blessing very quickly, but of a very extraordinary, uncanny kind. But you will be able to then internalize your ability to overcome all of the apparent horrors in the world, because each one is a microcosm. And if you are willing to go all the way into it and take it on that you are the one it's happening to, not another, because we are one, and compassionately swallowing, but only to the throat, that poison that creates the blue throat of Shiva, and then turning it into nectar, you will see that this is the secret moment in which a transformational fermentation of consciousness occurs, not just in that person or in you, but in the relationality in which this is recognized, and then that creates an energy field that will extend for whatever, without limits, in the morphogenic field of consciousness, because everyone at this moment needs to attune to that level, because every being right today has fallen into a rabbit hole, and there is no way out and no control in being in free fall. But nobody yet, or very few, have hit Wonderland at the bottom of that rabbit hole. So and Wonderland has many different regions. So you want to be able to really hit the jackpot. But you have to recognize that that where you are in your consciousness, and allow it to attain its ultimate destination. And it can do that in immediacy or in a future if it's resisted. And the more one says bring it on and allows it to be fully present, the more the whole ego and its suffering complex is exploded. Okay. All right. Well, I hope this has been of use to people, and that the sanskaras of fixation in a hell realm of suffering, or even a purgatory, can be recognized as your own dream, and imagined bars that you are putting to imprison yourself in, but they don't exist. There are no limitations, and you are the infinite light and creative intelligence that produces these dream fields, what we call our world, but we are not victims or subject to it. We are ultimately, and now at this moment, the dreamer. And it is the recognition and the surrender to that level of your being that brings salvation and brings immediate embodiment as a manifestation of that very beautiful and inconceivably wise consciousness that wants to manifest through your vehicle. So allow the blessing to be fulfilled in you. Let Christ live in you and not the ego. Let the Buddha mind fully flower. Allow Shiva to take the jiva and absorb that illusory self into the real for the benefit of all beings who will receive that vibrational frequency as the gateway to freedom. Namaste.